Still Alive, a look at people making things. The Clockmaker. Peter Brooks meets Simon Brock.
Today I'm going to be exploring the craft of clog making. Simon has invited me to visit him so he can take me through all of the various processes, and I'm in the workshop surrounded by wood, leather and some very odd looking tools.
If we come through into the woodworking part of the workshop, I'll begin there. Right, the first step is to take a lump of wood and make a sole from it. The wood I use is sycamore. Historically, alder was used. Beech is still sometimes used, but I find sycamore to be the best. I get it in the round, and sometimes I get it already planked to 5 inches wide by 3 inches thick, which is a good dimensions for making most different sizes of soles. The first part of making a sole is to put it on the bandsaw and cut what's known as the cast, which is the shape of the sole if you're looking at it sideways on. Having cut the cast, I then draw onto the top surface the shape of the sort of foot shape, if you like, and then cut that on the bandsaw. At this point, there's a jig on the bandsaw so that it's cutting at an angle of about 5 degrees, which just puts a slight taper on the sole all the way around, makes it look a bit more elegant. Also, I think probably helps with stability. The next step in shaping the sole is to put it on the disc sander. The first process on the disc sander is to true up the base of the sole so that the bottom of the heel and the part of the clog that's known as the balance point, which is where the sole just under the ball of the foot touches the ground, to make sure that they're in line with each other. And also to make sure that the cast is nice and smooth on the bottom so that you've not got any little ridges or rough patches if you're trying to walk or dance in them. It's also important that they match as a pair. Someone once said to me, it's easy to make one clog, it's fairly easy to make two clogs, but it's quite difficult to make a pair of clogs. Finally, on the disc sander, just shaping around the edge of the sole, just taking out the bandsaw marks from earlier on and making a nice, smooth-looking finished product, and by the time it comes off the disc sander, it already is starting to look like a clog sole. It just needs a little bit of refining on the hand tools, which is the next step. That's about the end of the machine processes, really, having done the bits on the bandsaw and the disc sander. So then we move on to the clog knives, hand tools, which I suppose you'd describe the first one. It's called the blocker. It's just a big blade with a quite a long curved tail to it and then a wooden handle on the end. That's the handle that you hold while you're using it. And then the other end is a hook that locates into an eye. On this bench. They're tools that people are generally quite fascinated with because they are specific to clog making, and so unless you've seen them in action in a clog making sort of setting before, it's unlikely that you'd ever have encountered these tools. In the old days, the clog makers would have shaped the whole sole just using these hand tools, but day to day I just use the blocker to reduce the weight of the sole a little bit, taking out some of the material between what's known as the balance point, which is where the clog sole touches the ground, just about where the ball of the foot is, from there back to the heel. And it's a really efficient tool for removing material in that area and just making the sole a bit more lightweight. Well, also very satisfying to use. The second of the clog knives is the hollower, which, as the name suggests, is used for hollowing or for adding a concave surface to the top of the clog sole. So having come off the bandsaw, it's quite a flat shape. It's not particularly ergonomic. It's not well suited to the human foot. So the hollower is used to shape the top of the sole, the part that your foot sits on, so that it's a friendlier shape for the foot. Very much like the blocker, it sort of looks the same, but instead of having a wide cutting edge, it's got a much smaller compound curve cutting edge, which is just, again, ideally designed for scooping out material in the way that it needs to be done.
Looking around the workshop, there's a lot of aged-looking yeah. equipment and things here. Can you tell us a bit about a few of those?
A lot of that has come to me in quite serendipitous ways. The clog knives, they were a fellow called Bob, who lived on the South Coast, who just happened to mention to a friend of mine that he had a set of clog knives, and she told me, and I went down there and got them. And he was a Lancashire lad, and his stipulation was, as long as they go back up north and they get used, I could have them for nothing, which was great, because they're really quite difficult tools to track down. And when you can, you know, they're a few hundred quid, so certainly grateful to him for that. The last that I've got, the wooden shoe forms, they came from another retired clogmaker called Rick Rubitsky. And he had a great reputation in the 80s and 90s. His clogs are still very well regarded. But it just transpired that a girl who was living next door to me in Sheffield, her dad went to the pub with Rick in some, you know, fairly remote village in Somerset. So it was an amazing coincidence. I thought I was going to have trouble tracking him down, because I wanted to talk to him about clog making and find out what advice he could give me and so on. And in the end, it was just as easy as asking my neighbour for his number. Went to see him. After a little while, I managed to convince him that I was serious. And so he sold me all of the equipment that he'd had in store since he retired from clog making in the 90s. And I think, which I can understand, he wanted to be sure that it was going to a good home, all of this stuff that he'd used when he was making clogs. And I think I've satisfied him now that it's been well used and well looked after.
There's a nice continuity there, isn't there, of an old craft and somebody retiring and then passing everything on to a younger man to pick up and carry on with it all, really?
Yeah, I mean, some of the stuff that Rick sold me already has had quite a lot of history when he acquired it. So the bench I use for nailing up on, I think we worked out that it's probably from before the First World War. You know, it was already old when he got it. A lot of the lasts he didn't have made, some of those are from between the wars, I think, or shortly after the Second World War. So yeah, it's not just continuity from the sort of last generation clogmakers to me. There's a continuity that goes even further back than that, which, yeah, it's really nice.
After I first started to discuss clogs with Simon, I wondered how long they'd been around for, so I tracked down a clog historian.
Hello, I'm Michael Jackson. I'm a clog enthusiast. I've performed Morris dances in clogs for over 40 years. I have been researching clogs for many years, and I'm aiming to research and write the history of clog making.
Could you give us some historical background to clog use, you know, when the first recorded use is, that kind of thing?
What we think of as a clog is a shoe or a boot with a wooden sole and a leather upper. And that particular type of footwear appears to have originated in the 17th century. So from the 1600s onwards, people were making shoes with wooden soles, leather uppers, not to a very great extent, but in certain parts of the country, that trade was beginning to develop. However, the history of wooden footwear in England, in Britain, dates back many hundreds of years before then. And probably the earliest records of shoes made with wood date back to Roman times. Some French writers say the Romans got the idea from the ancient Gauls. Who knows? And if the ancient Gauls already had wooden-soled footwear, perhaps the ancient Britons did.
From then, they obviously diverged into a variety of uses as time progressed, presumably.
They did. It was a long process of evolution before footwear that looked like a wooden sandal evolved into a clog with a proper upper. For many hundreds of years, through the Middle Ages, we had a type of footwear known as pattens. And the purpose of pattens was simply to be worn over the delicate and perhaps not very waterproof shoes of the day. Essentially, that's the basis of what became the clog. It's fairly straightforward, a piece of wood with some leather attached to it, which you can tie over a shoe. And after people in this country had been making and wearing them for hundreds of years, at some point somebody had the bright idea that rather than having to wear them over other shoes, why not put a shoe upper on them and you can just wear them as a complete shoe? That type of clog then started becoming much more popular from the 18th century onwards. In particular, demand really took off when Britain started to industrialise.
Michael had given me some idea of the history behind clog use, so now it was time to head back to the workshop to make a start on the leather.
Having got a pair of finished soles, the next step is to make some uppers for them. I do a number of different styles of uppers. The most common is called in Gibson, which is a lace-up style. I suppose from a distance they just look like a normal shoe, really, which I guess is part of the appeal. There's a lot of adjustment in that style as well because of the lacing. A more traditional style is the clasp clog, which just has one single fastening, which is a little metal clasp right over the instep. So that's a style that's nice if you want the more traditional look, but they do look very much like clogs then, so they're quite conspicuous. And I do a T-bar style as well, particularly popular with the Welsh step dancers, the young ladies who do Welsh step dancing, like T-bar clog, particularly in bright colours, patent leathers, that kind of thing. So there's some people are very adventurous with the colours and styles that they want for their clogs. A lot of the English step dancing market is just making black lace-ups, so a little bit more conservative taste. They're all made in much the same way. They start life as a roll of leather. So just get the leather out of the paper, roll that out on the bench, and then I've got a series of templates for all the different sizes and pattern pieces. Just lay the template on the leather, draw around it, and then cut it out with a knife. It really is as low tech as that. For some of the more common sizes and the more common components, I've had some press knives made, so I can make those a little bit more efficiently on the fly press. Fly press is, well, a really big lump of metal, as I know from when we came to install it in the workshop. It took five of us to get it onto its stand. Basically, there's a screw mechanism and a long handle which provides a lot of leverage. And if you swing the handle, the screw mechanism goes downwards and it exerts an awful lot of pressure on whatever's underneath. On the bottom of the fly press here, I've got a plate which will exert pressure on these press knives that I've had made. They're like cookie cutters, but in the shape of parts of a clog upper. So we pop the leather under the fly press on a cutting mat, pop the cookie cutter on top, and then just give it a big old swing. And there we are, that's that piece cut. When making the lace-up styles, another important step is to fit eyelets. So you have to punch a little hole in the leather for each one of the lace eyelets. And then we press the little eyelets in. And finally set them with a little die and setting tool. And once all the pattern pieces are cut and eyelets are set, if necessary, then it's just a case of sticking the different bits of the pattern together. And stitching those parts together until we end up with something that looks like, yeah, of course, it's not a finished shoe or a finished foot shape at this stage, but it's heading in the right direction. So that makes life a little bit easier for me when I come to last it later on. The sewing machine I've got in the workshop is an antique Singer 29K, if you're geeky about sewing machines. It's a shoe repair machine, really. It's got a very long, narrow bed, which means that it offers a lot of flexibility and it is ideal for stitching up clog and shoe uppers. I'm not quite sure when this machine's from, but sometime around the middle of the 20th century, I think. The machine's treadle powered, but to be honest, I don't use the treadle because the runs of stitching that I have to do are so short. I tend just to use the balance wheel. It's not like I'm stitching metres and metres at a time. Most of the seams are really quite small on clog uppers.
Michael had told me that clog use had grown alongside Britain's industrialisation, so I now wanted to find out when they started to go into decline.
Clogs still maintained a certain amount of popularity in certain professions well into the 1970s and into the 1980s. One business in Yorkshire, owned by Frank Walkley at Hebden Bridge, he specialised in producing clogs for industrial uses and sold to foundries, gasworks and the like. But the point came when those industrial users pulled the plug. He was selling them safety clogs, but they turned to boots instead.
So now the current use is relatively specialised, isn't it, for foam courts, effectively for dancing and so on?
I would say that has been the main demand for the past few decades. There has always been a certain amount of nostalgia. Now that people have got over the fact that they're associated with the past, it's something that now appeals to some people. And there will be people who just wear clogs because of their association with Lancashire and Yorkshire's heritage. But they're also popular with what are called Northwest Morris dancers, clog dancers, and a limited number of sword dancers wear clogs. In Sheffield, for instance, there's a team called Grenaside, based in one of the villages on the fringe of Sheffield, and that's a Yorkshire longsword team, and they're dancing clogs. It's fairly unusual, but they keep up that part of their heritage to the present day.
I'm interested to know how this all started, so over to the workshop again. Would you tell us a bit about yourself, Simon, how you got into making clogs?
Well, funnily enough, Peter, it wasn't an option that was given to me by the school's careers advisor. I sort of got into it as most people get into these slightly obscure professions by accident. I trained as a furniture maker, did furniture making HND at Leeds Art College, and then worked in furniture restoration for a couple of years. I had a midlife crisis when I was 23 and went to Canada to work on a sheep farm for 6 months. And then shortly after I got back, I met a chap called Trevor Owen at Whitby Folk Week. And he's a well-known clog maker. He's been making for the dance market for 30-some years, I think. Just got chatting to him, obviously, with the furniture background. I was interested in the wooden soles and said, how do you make these? And very kindly said, well, come to the workshop and I'll show you. So I went and stayed with him for a week. And he's been a great mentor to me throughout, really. Very generous with his time and knowledge ever since then.
So did that week, I mean, presume that's not long enough to learn the trade, did that just sort of give you a taste for things then? Or?
Yeah, because I had not done any leather working before that point. So I used that week just I realised I was really interested in clog making as a result of that. Then went away and taught myself leatherworking for 4 or 5 years. And the next time I was at Whitby Folk Week with Trevor, he said, why aren't you making clogs yet? So I sort of took it back up again then, having got the leather working under my belt. And I went to see Trevor again. This time, a few kind of 2-3 day little stints I did with him, which again isn't enough to learn it, but with plenty of practice in between, it was a good start. And of course, all the existing craft skills I had.
The clogs we've been working on are almost finished. What's next?
Now we've got to put the sole and the upper together, and that's a process that's known as lasting, named for the last, which is the former over which the leather is stretched. So it's part approximation of the human foot and part style. So the last also dictates things like the toe shape and any other sort of shapes that the leather upper will take. This is the most important stage for getting a custom fitting clog. So part of the custom fitting can be done when the soles are made. So if someone's got a particularly wide foot, then the soles, because I make them all from scratch, the soles can be made wider to fit. So the last themselves are just a standard size, but they can easily be adapted by tacking on little bits of leather. So if you've got a high instep or bunions or wide toes or hammer toes or anything like that, then all of that sort of information, if you like, has to be reflected in the last. Once I'm happy that the last is going to fit, is going to be like the customer's foot, they need to soak the leather. It varies from a few minutes to up to sort of 3/4 of an hour or so, depending on the type of leather I'm using for that particular pair of clogs. But soaking the leather in some warm water just helps the leather to become more pliable. It means that it'll then stretch down over the last, but then once it dries, it'll take the shape of the last and it'll hold that shape. And the first step is to grab that wet upper, just give it a little shake, get some of the water off, let it drip dry a little bit, and then pop that upper onto the sole, and I'm going to tack it at the back to fix the upper in place at the back. Having done that, it's then just a case of going round and stretching the leather evenly over the last. I use these lasting pliers, which are designed for the job. You just grab hold of the leather with the pliers, stretch the leather down and tack it in place. This can be quite a long process. It depends on the leather. Sometimes the leather you'll find has a little bit of stretchiness in a part of it that you perhaps didn't expect, and that has to be accounted for. So there can be quite a lot of going around and taking these little tacks out and correcting. Sometimes it goes really quickly, but just as often, it's a process that requires some doing and redoing to get it just right. Once it looks like it's going to hold, then we can just leave the leather to dry. A couple of days in the summer, maybe 3 or 4 days in the winter. I like to try and get a bit of lasting up done on Friday if I can, and then I know that the clogs are going to be ready for me to work on Monday morning. And there we go, we'll just leave that to dry. After the leather's dried on the last, the final step is nailing up. So this is a stage that's going to involve taking out all of those little tacks that were put in during the lasting stage, they're just temporary, and finally nailing the leather to the wooden sole with some nice shiny brass nails. So first of all, the excess leather has to be trimmed off so that it's flush with the edge of that rebate. And then we're ready to go with the brass nails. This is when the thing really starts to come together.
How do you go about selling clogs then, Simon?
Well, I've got a couple of different ways of doing that. There's the website, which is where most of the inquiries come from, particularly obviously over the last year and a bit. I've not been able to be out on the road. But ordinarily, I do a few festivals and step dancing events and things throughout the year. But most of the time, the inquiries come through the website, and then people will either come to the workshop for a fitting. I get quite a bit of business from abroad, Russia, Australia, the US, being the main overseas markets. So those people have to send me drawings of their feet through the post, which is quite fun when you get an envelope of foot drawings from St. Petersburg.
So do you, you know, at folk festivals, for example, would you go there and drum up custom from people attending?
That's the idea, yeah. I normally do Whitby Folk Week. I've mentioned that's where I met my mentor, Trevor Owen, earlier on. I kind of took over his pitch at Whitby. And then the other events I do tend to be a little bit more specific step dancing events. I've made clogs for a number of very prominent and very well-respected step dancers, including my near neighbour, Sheffield-based Melanie Barber.
My name's Melanie Barber. I'm a Lancashire clog dancer. I was one of the early people that got Simon's clogs made for them. So I'm going to be dancing for you today in Simon's clogs, and I dance with Strictly Clog. I'm going to dance a dance that Strictly wrote when we were challenged to write a dance to a traditional 10-8 Swedish waltz. So this is Strictly Clog to the Pelletbalsen.
Clogmaker is Simon Brock. The clog historian is Michael Jackson. The clog dancer is Melanie Barber, accompanied by Mike Adamson. The Still Alive theme music was composed and played by Frank Birtwistle. The making of Still Alive was supported by the Audio Content Fund. Still Alive is presented and produced by Peter Brooks for UpperHearst.com.